You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire, 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko otou toku ingoa. Nau mai, hare mai ki te wire mō tēnei rā. Kia ora, and welcome to The Wire for Ra'apa Wednesday. I'm your host Otto, and I'll be with you for the next hour. I'm also joined by BFM News Director Joel. If I Akine, coming up on the show, Mariam, an Iranian New Zealander who is currently in Iran at the moment, will be talking to us about the missile strikes between Israel and Iran from her perspective. Stefan Hoadley, a retired associate professor from the University of Auckland, will be speaking to us about the Israeli-Iranian conflict from a broader angle. For our weekly catch-up with the Green Party's Ricardo Menendez March, we'll be talking about the government's consideration to change sick leave payments, the directive to Health New Zealand to give private hospitals outsourcing contracts for elective surgeries, and David Seymour's review into ECE funding. And I will also be speaking to Te Kahu Ratai Moko Painting, a professional teaching fellow at the Centre for Pūtaiao at the University of Auckland, about why some iwi celebrate Puanga instead of Matariki. News and editorial director Joel will be speaking to Professional Association for Transgender Health Aotearoa's Jennifer Shields and AUT's Greg Treadwell regarding a story on RNZ which may have raised concerns about the lack of usage of an individual's preferred name and gender identity due to the individual having passed away and not being able to communicate his wishes. He aha o whakaro, I'd love to hear your thoughts on any of these pieces, so get in touch. Tuku pātui mai, text in on 5395, or waia mai rāne, give us a call in the studio on 309-3879. Kaua e ware ware e āhi ana koutou te whakarongo ki ēne kōrero, anō hi pakiheri roki roki mārunga te pai tukutuku o irirangi pōho mei haere ki 95BFM irakati.com. You can catch all of these stories and more on podcast by podcast on the 95BFM website, 95BFM.com. Last Friday, Israel launched a series of missile strikes on Iranian soil aimed at destroying Iran's nuclear facilities and assassinating their top generals and scientists. In response, Iran fired a series of their own missile strikes into Israeli territory, striking areas like Tel Aviv and the port city of Haifa. Both countries have attacked civilian areas in this round of fighting, with Israeli strikes into Iran hitting Iran's state broadcaster in Tehran, as well as the Farabi Hospital in Kermanshah, killing at least 200 people, with Iran strikes targeting a number of residential areas in urban Israel similarly. I spoke to an Iranian New Zealander who is currently in Iran at the moment, going under the alias of Mariam for her safety and security, who talked to us about her experiences trying to flee Iran and contacting the New Zealand government for assistance.
To begin, can you describe the situation in Tehran right now from your perspective?
From my perspective, it's absolute chaos. And, no one knows where to go that's safe. There's shortages of fuel, clear directions on where to go, where not to go, what to do, what not to do. So everyone's just basing their opinions on what other people are saying. We got the order to evacuate from the New Zealand embassy yesterday, which we did. I was in the District 3 area, so I've evacuated outside of Tehran. We couldn't go too far because of the traffic as well. So we're close by where we could possibly get hit or not. We don't know.
So just to reiterate, have you and other people in your situation been able to access shelter easily?
I would say no. I mean, the only places we have is like our homes and that's it. Nowhere safe. There's no bunkers. There's really nowhere besides the only thing that the Iranian government has told us is you can shelter in the train stations. That's it.
Right. Can you describe the process of evacuation and what evacuating has been like for Iranians and Iranian New Zealanders such as yourself who are trying to leave the country at the moment?
Well, when we got the email to evacuate, we literally started scrambling everything together, just trying to get everything together so we can leave. And while we were doing that, within the next 5 minutes or so, they started bombing the area that we were in. So we just literally rushed just to leave Tehran. We didn't know where to go, where it was safe. So we ended up leaving and we went to a city close by south of Tehran. And when we got there, the locals said that everyone here left as well because there's missiles around here. So we left that area. We came to another area, which I don't know if it's safe for me to say where or not. It's just south of Tehran. So that's where we're at the moment. But we don't know if it's safe here. For how long it will be safe, we don't know.
Can you describe your experiences with contacting the New Zealand government or the Ministry of Foreign Affairs at this period of time?
I contacted them the first day that this whole thing happened, and they didn't really tell me what to do besides you can either stay put, stay in Tehran, seek shelter, or you can leave the country, which is something that we advise. But how do I leave the country? I've been trying to, from day one, I've been trying to leave the country by just getting to the Turkish border, but there's literally no buses, no trains, nothing to get there. I was arranging a private taxi to take me to the Turkish border yesterday, but we got the email to evacuate. Now I'm currently in this tiny little village. It's just impossible for me to get to the Turkish border right now. So the only thing I'm asking the New Zealand government to do is try to find a way to evacuate its citizens that's currently trapped in Iran. And I believe there's 46 of us here currently.
Do you think that the New Zealand government has responded adequately to the situation in Iran at the moment?
I would say no. Comparing it to citizens from another country such as America, Australia, Canada, no, New Zealand has not done what it needs to do to ensure the safety of its citizens. So no, I'm quite sad about it because I had this feeling of having a New Zealand passport could give you safety, but right now I feel like it doesn't mean anything.
What do you think the government of New Zealand could be doing to ensure the safe passage of Iranian New Zealanders who are in Iran at the moment?
Honestly, if they can just arrange a way for us to get to the Turkish border somehow, that's all that we're asking for. Just get us to the Turkish border, somehow do that, because we can't do it ourselves. It's becoming very impossible to do that. Once we get to Turkey, it's fine. We'll figure something out.
Are there any other options for Iranian New Zealanders at the moment to flee the country?
No. I mean, anywhere you go in Iran is just not safe. So the only thing we can think about is getting to the Turkish border. And there are other borders as well. But I don't want to get political. I don't want to get into reasons why we don't want to go that route.
I think that's about everything from me. But is there anything else you'd like to mention before you finish off, or any calls you'd like to make to the New Zealand government?
I would like the New Zealand government to ensure the safety of its citizens and actually have a plan, do something about it, not just pretend that they care. That's all.
And that was Mariam, an Iranian New Zealander in Iran, talking to us about the Israeli-Iranian conflict in her perspective and her attempts to contact the New Zealand government for assistance.
Is it too late in the process, though, to change that?
Nothing's too late, bro. Everything's made up in politics.
The Wire.
Following our previous conversation with Mariam in Iran, we speak to Professor Stefan Hoadley, a retired associate professor of international relations at the University of Auckland, for a discussion about the wider context surrounding the recent rounds of fighting between Israel and Iran. Stefan has stressed that his views are his own and not related to any institutions he has worked for in the past. So to begin, what is the most likely outcome for Iran and Israel in the most recent rounds of fighting between the two states?
In the short run, continued fighting, exchange of missiles. Israelis will continue to bomb the military targets, the nuclear targets, and some of the leadership targets of Iran. Iran will continue to use its vast stock of missiles to continue bombarding Israel. We're talking days, maybe weeks. It'll gradually fizzle out. The Iranians are going to run out of missiles. They're going through all their best ones. The ones they have left are old, deteriorated. Perhaps they won't even fire. They will be poorly aimed, which is bad news for Israel because it means those rockets, even if they're aimed at military targets in Israel, will end up falling on civilians. So that's not a good look. But when the missiles stop coming from Iran, then Israel will probably pause its airstrikes and then will move into a period of negotiation, whether that negotiation is led by Donald Trump, who very much wants to be in the center of the action and claim credit for any ceasefire that may occur, or led by the Saudis, or by the Qataris, or some other European group, that remains to be seen.
Regarding Iran's nuclear program, do you think that an agreement like the Obama administration's Iran nuclear deal could be revived to achieve a ceasefire?
It would be a step in the right direction, but what we note is that the Iranians had 20% of highly enriched uranium at the time of the Obama agreement, and now they have 80%. And that means that during the period of time when both there was, the agreement was in force and when Trump canceled the United States participation in it, the Iranians have continued gradually and relentlessly to enrich more and more uranium towards weapons-grade level. Nevertheless, the claim is made, I think, that the two sides are talking past each other, and that consequently the debate is, does Iran have enough fissile material that they could make a bomb within a few weeks? This is the claim of the Israelis. This is disputed. On the other hand, Grossi of the International Atomic Energy Agency did say that the Iranians are not in compliance with their agreements. The Iranians are, in fact, enriching uranium. They have denied access to the IAEA inspectors. We don't know exactly what they have, how close they are to a bomb. So the many governments are simply assuming the worst, that if nothing is done, Iran would have achieved some sort of nuclear device by the end of this year at the latest. Well, that's not going to happen. The Israelis have, too, the secret approval of many Arab countries, although they've condemned Israel rhetorically. Secretly, they're quite pleased that the nuclear program has been put back.
Are we expected to see similar levels of civilian casualties, both in Iran and in Israel, as we've seen in the rounds of fighting between Israel and Hezbollah and Lebanon and Israel and Hamas in Gaza?
I think so. As long as the Israeli airstrikes continue, they do target leaders, atomic scientists, generals of the Islamic Guard and others, and innocent civilians will be killed. The death count is apparently something around 250 in Iran. It will definitely climb. And as long as Iran continues to bombard Israel with its missiles, the death toll will grow in Israel as well. You might note that the Israel death toll is about one-tenth that of Iran. Why is that? Because Israel is prepared. Every Israeli has a shelter nearby, and consequently, Israelis are well prepared for combat. The civilians know how to protect themselves, those that aren't drafted into the army, and consequently, the fatalities in Israel will always be much less because of the preparation made by the government and by civil society in Israel. Whereas Iran, totally unprepared, never thought that this would happen. And consequently, yes, sadly, there will be a number of innocent Iranians who will be killed as collateral damage. But I stress that the Israeli, or I believe the Israelis, when they say they never deliberately target civilians, I believe that is true. But it doesn't mean that civilians won't be killed unintentionally.
And lastly, what conditions would be needed to achieve a total ceasefire?
Well, that's a very good question. The Israelis would say as long as the Iranians would forswear their nuclear program, the war would stop instantly. The Iranians would say as long as Israel promises not to attack further, and also this attacking includes espionage, sabotage, cyber attack. Remember, the Israelis have instruments of statecraft, which they have used against Iran in the past, as Iran has many instruments of statecraft against Israel in the past. So the halting of all of these would bring the hostilities to an end. But I would stress that just the stopping of the military exchanges wouldn't stop the hostility. That is, as long as the Ayatollahs are in charge in Iran, then the elimination of Israel as a state, and perhaps the dispersal of the Jews as well from the Middle East, that is their elimination from the territory of Israel, what we call the Middle East or the Holy Land, would be also on the agenda. That will not change. Likewise, the Israeli determination that they will protect their state, that they have a legitimate historic historically legitimized claim to the land on which they sit, they will continue to do efficiently with possibly support from the United States. Indirect support, yes. Maybe direct support in the future if the conflict continues. And that's another big question that we have to keep an eye on. At what point will the United States join the military action? At the moment, Trump doesn't want to. Trump wants to pull out of the wars, the forever wars in the Middle East and other parts of the world. And his half of his Republican MAGA base want him to not support Israel, but the other half want him to. They support Israel and think that American military support for Israel against a potentially nuclear-armed Iran would be a very good thing. So debate is divided in the United States, and that's another variable in this highly complex situation that we're discussing today.
And that was Stefan Hoadley, a retired associate professor from the University of Auckland, talking about the Israeli-Iranian conflict from a broader angle. We'll be back after a quick break. Keep it on the B. 95 BFM.
فارسی بلدی میگه ماره خیلی زیاد 8 سالم بود رفتم از ایران بیرون ولی باز ایرانی و خارجی فرقی نداره واسه ما پرچم نیوزلند و ایران بالا بالا پرچم اهواز داره بالا بالا پرچم اوکلند داره بالا بالا میگن چقدر قرصن میگم ماره ماره پرچم پرچم بالا تو که دیدی هستم اینجا حالا پرچم بالا
زمان ما خجلتش من وحدة بتطلع فيه لما دخلت الغرفة صدقتش انك مش لي عامل حالك مش عارفاني طيب اوكي ماشي يا غالي اذا هيك الحلوة بتتصرف شكله حتعذبني اي واي يو كيل مي سوفلي واي يو كيل مي سلو قشرت الكلمنتينة منينة زي لقطو واي يو كيل مي سوفلي واي يو كيل مي سلو رومانسي انا يا حبيبه if you want me then let me know
I don't wanna lie but you might be the love of my life and I just get you think I'm in love with a vibe but she looked me in the eye and said I like your style took you out for the very first time and there's just something about you I don't wanna lie but I made you mine from the moment I met you mine
I think I was meant for you I think you were meant for me you looking so good tonight you might be the remedy And all of this time I was looking, but you were in front of me. Oh. صار لي زمان ما خشيتش من وحدة بتطلع فيك. لما دخلت الغرفة صدقتش إنك مش لي. عامل حالك مش عارفاني. طيب أوكي ماشي يا غالي. إذا هيك الحلوة بتتصرف شكله حتعذبني أي. Why you killing me softly? Why you killing me slow? قشرت الكلمنتينة.
مهما عملتي اديك انا عيني وانت نيا زي ما تتمني يا امورة شوف انا الصورة بتجنن كده شطورة معاكي في زعب على سما سبعة بيبي مش هنزل انا كان say I'm taking it slow baby you took me right out my zone I usually nervous but I froze got me talking to bro like hey bro she killing me softly killing me slow سيب الليلة يا حبي للاشي وشوف
صار لي زمان ما خشبتش من وحدة بتطلع فيك لما دخلت دخلت الغرفة صدقتش انك مش لي عامل حالك مش عارفاني طيب بك ماشي يا غالي اذا هيك الحلوة بتتصرف شكله حتعذبني اي واي يو كلمة صافي واي يو كلمة صافي قشرت الكلمنتينة مينة سيدة قدو واي يو كلمة صافي واي يو كلمة صافي ما منسي انا يا حبيبي if you want me then let me know
Philharmonia is doing another performance of that famous guy's music.
Who?
You know that guy? Ba 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 ba.
Oh, he looks kind of grumpy in that painting.
Beethoven!
The Auckland Philharmonia plays Beethoven's iconic Fifth Symphony at the Auckland Town Hall, Wednesday, June 25th at 6:30. For tickets and more info, go to aucklandphil.nz.
Check out the coolest exhibition at New Zealand Maritime Museum, Hui Te Ananui a Tangaroa, Into Ocean and Ice. Go on a polar journey to Antarctica and experience five artists' interpretations of the fragile beauty of this epic landscape. From Ernest Shackleton's heroic expeditions to the climate-threatened island of South Georgia. Into Ocean and Ice. On now until August 31st, 2025. Free entry with museum admission. For more info, go to maritimemuseum.co.nz.
Bon appetit, 95BFM listeners. We've just brewed up a combo of hot tunes and cold beers.
That's right. Drive Island at the Beer Spot Morningside is back. Friday, June 27. Come hang out, have a cold one, and watch some live performances by two iconic bands. Boom! And Cindy. 95BFM Drive Island at the Beer Spot Morningside. Friday, June 27, from 4 till 7pm. See you there.
Oh, good day, Frank.
Yeah, it's high tide now as well, so yeah.
What is it? Was this 3 foot, is it?
Yeah, at least. So yeah.
Is it onshore? Yeah, onshore's a good one, eh?
Yeah.
Yeah, cool. Yeah.
Oh. Here comes a good one.
You get it.
No, it's okay. You go for it.
No, I insist.
Okay. Damn, I missed it.
No, that was close, though. You did really well.
Thank you. Actually, I might head in. My board doesn't feel properly waxed.
Yeah, I think I'll join you. It's getting a bit messy out here now anyway.
Yeah, so we just got to get it flat white.
The 95BFM Surf Report. All the surf, all the time. Weekdays on Breakfast and Drive. Thanks to Pro Gear Photographic.
Now it's time to hear from the Green Party's Ricardo Menendez March.
No mai hoki mai, welcome back to The Wire on 95BFM. Once again, if you have any thoughts on any of these pieces, give us a text on 5395 or call us on 309-3879. Prime Minister Christopher Luxon recently spoke to media saying that the government would announce reforms to the Holidays Act that would impact sick leave entitlements for part-time workers. Under the suggested changes, sick leave entitlements would be processed under an accrual system, meaning that part-time workers working half the hours of their full-time counterparts might only earn half of their previously entitled sick leave. In that same week, a directive was recently given to Te Whatu Ora Health New Zealand to give private hospitals 10-year outsourcing contracts to perform elective surgeries. And earlier this week, Associate Education Minister David Seymour announced a review of the funding for early childhood education. For our weekly catch-up with the Green Party, we speak to MP Ricardo Menendez March about all of these issues.
So, to begin, what is the Green Party's position on the potential changes to sick leave entitlements for part-time workers?
Reducing sick leave is a kick in the gut for workers. It risks the health of people in the workplace, but also we have to acknowledge that many of our part-time jobs are customer-fronting in areas like hospitality and retail. And that risks getting our broader community sick as well. I think this just shows a complete disregard for the health of our people. And just off the back of a pandemic where we've got people actually still with a really high rate of respiratory tract infections, it's incredibly irresponsible.
Additionally, how could these changes impact women and expectant workers?
We know that our workers who are like disabled women and many other groups already more at risk of getting sick and being failed by our health institutions will be disproportionately impacted. And when we also know that many women are working in low-paid, undervalued jobs, this will also damage them, as well as having to, for example, grapple with the fact that many women are juggling part-time work with caregiving responsibilities.
After the number of sick days was increased from 5 to 10 by the previous Labour government, the average rate of absence from work during their tenure increased from approximately 4.7 to 5.5 days per employee. Do you think that these changes could have an impact on employee productivity?
Yes, it will. And that's also another negative contributing factor. But we also got to remember that it will also put a strain on our health system. When people are showing up to work sick, it actually risks that very same illness getting worse, and then putting a strain on our health system and making that person actually be less able to fulfill their duties at work for longer. It's just irresponsible, and it makes absolutely no sense. All I can describe it as is the cruel move by the government just further strip away workers' rights.
Without bringing the proposed changes into effect, are the current sick leave entitlements sufficient enough for employees?
No, they're not. And this is part of the problem, is that already, and following a pandemic, sick leave entitlements don't often support and adequately cover people who may be facing serious health challenges. For low-wage workers, not being able to take sick leave and having to, for example, not be at work without pay could mean the difference between being able to put food on the table and pay your bills.
All right, moving on to the next topic. A directive was recently given to Te Whatu Ora Health New Zealand to give private hospitals 10-year outsourcing contracts to perform elective surgeries. Health New Zealand had previously been negotiating 3-year agreements with private hospitals. However, Health Minister Simeon Brown's new directive would push the agency to move towards longer-term agreements, which Brown said would improve the cost-effectiveness of delivery and provide clear investment signals to the private sector. My next question is, what is the Green Party's position on the directive to Health New Zealand to adopt 10-year agreements with private hospitals?
Healthcare is a right and should not be left to businesses who seek to make a profit out of the health of our communities. And it's deeply, deeply worrying to see the government further prioritising the private sector instead of investing on our public healthcare system. We've got hospital infrastructure that needs adequate investment and upgrading. We've already seen how the government hasn't committed to building the Dunedin Hospital to the degree that the communities in Otago deserves. We've got a crumbling primary health care sector, and we're already seeing the impacts of having, for example, our GPs being run as a private entity. And what this will do down the line is create the conditions for further privatization and diminishing the investment in the public healthcare system, which will lead to poor health outcomes.
Health New Zealand Commissioner Lester Levy has said that longer-term private sector contracts would clear backlogs and allow the agency to build more capacity in the system. How would you respond to that?
Lester Levy has just been a lapdog for the government and has continued to push forward narratives that only support the government's intent to move us towards a much more privatized system. Lester Levy is wrong. The government can make different choices. The government could choose to have a tax on the wealthy few so that we can adequately invest in our public healthcare system instead of giving public resources to private entities that ultimately are here to make a profit, not prioritize the well-being and the health of our communities.
Levy also said that health services had always been outsourced to the private sector and criticized the previous Labour government for having wait times of more than 4 months for elective surgeries. How would you respond to that?
It is true that successive governments, Labour and National, have not been bold enough to tax the wealthy few so that we can invest an adequate amount of resources into our public healthcare system. But that shouldn't be a reason to basically further privatize the healthcare system, which will have negative impacts in our communities. We just got to look at the US, to see how in the US accessing adequate healthcare is really difficult for everyday people, to the point that so many of our middle-income people are having to travel overseas to get basic healthcare treatment. And that is because they have moved to basically an almost fully privatized healthcare system. That is not the path that New Zealand should be going towards.
And how would a Greens-led government address the backlog and undercapacity in the health system?
By introducing tax reform so that we can actually invest in our public healthcare system, as well as through our fiscal strategy, which completely overhauls the way that governments have done budgets, we can show that we have the resources available to adequately invest in things like primary health, as well as hospital infrastructure, to ensure that our public healthcare system can deal with long wait times and address the failures of successive Labour national governments.
All right, moving on to the last topic. Earlier this week, Associate Education Minister David Seymour announced a review for the funding of early childhood education. The review's terms of reference say that an advisory group would provide insight on the balance between quality and affordability for services, additionally saying that high costs in the sector were restricting access to early childhood education. My next question is, what is the Green Party's take on the review of the ECE sector?
Throughout this term, the government has continued to undermine the wages of ECE workers and has continued to treat our early childhood education system as a for-profit entity, when actually we should be prioritizing the well-being of some of our youngest in this country. They deserve good quality education, and they also deserve teachers that are adequately paid and valued, and the review actually simply takes us further down the line of treating ECE as a for-profit business.
Are these sectors' funding streams too complex for parents and services, as the review's terms have suggested?
The reality is that we're pumping countless of millions of dollars into subsidizing private entities. I think that what we would do instead of what the government is trying to do is actually start moving the early childhood education sector into the hands of the public system, so that actually all the resources that the government is pumping into the ECE sector are going into improving education outcomes and the well-being of early childhood education workers, instead of subsidizing businesses that are making huge profits.
How do you expect funding streams for the sector to be impacted by this review?
We're particularly worried about the impact on Māori and other groups that have been disadvantaged. This is why we can't just have, a for-profit system, because it ends up leaving some of our most underserved communities. And by underserved, I mean people who the government has failed to acknowledge in their policies. And we're going to see this replicated in the ECE review as well. What this shows is that the government isn't committing and prioritizing the well-being of our youngest and the people who are working in the early childhood education sector, who are now facing potentially lower starting wages as a result of the government's recent policy reviews.
And lastly, how would a Greens-led government manage funding for the ECE sector?
What we would do instead is, like I said, start moving the ECE sector into the public system, which means that instead of subsidizing private entities, we would simply be better resourcing and ensuring that all the dollar figures that go into the ECE sector are going into building better quality education, better paid staff, and good conditions for our youngest.
And that was the Green Party's Ricardo Menendez-March speaking to us about the government's consideration to change sick leave payments, the directive to Health New Zealand to give private hospitals outsourcing contracts for elective surgeries, and David Seymour's review into ECE funding.
That was the Green Party's Ricardo Menendez-March.
Māori grievances about land are historical. We didn't wake up in the 1970s all angry and protesty and, started demanding our things back.
The Wire.
This Friday, the Matariki stars will be observed in the northeastern skies, marking the beginning of the Māori New Year and the Maramataka, the Māori lunar calendar. However, earlier this year, the Puanga star rose in the western skies, which some iwi, especially those in Te Tai Tokero, look to mark the beginning of the Maramataka. With this year's theme for Matariki being Matariki Mā Puanga, celebrating together, I spoke to Te Kahuratai Moko Painting, a professional teaching fellow at Te Putahi o Putaiao, the Centre for Putaiao at the University of Auckland, about why some iwi look to Puanga instead of Matariki. So to begin, can you tell us about the difference between Puanga and Matariki?
Yeah, so the basics are the different stars within different constellations. Puanga is the eighth brightest star, Rigel, within the constellation of Orion, whereas Matariki is quite a bit to the left in a very tight star cluster that's quite faint. So just in terms of looking into the sky and what you see, they're quite different in that way.
So why do some iwi look for Puanga to mark the beginning of the Maramataka instead of Matariki?
Yeah, so there's a few different reasons why they would use Puanga instead of Matariki. If you go across the Pacific Ocean, like to Tahiti, Rarotonga, Rapa Nui, Hawaii, for example, all of those places you'd see Matariki rising in the morning around this time, around the time of the winter solstice, before you'd see Puanga. But when you come down to the lower latitudes of Aotearoa, you see Puanga rising about a week earlier than Matariki. But if you look across indigenous astronomies across the globe, you'd see stories at this time of year specifically about Matariki, about Pleiades. Matariki, and slight variations on that name, is the word that we use all across the Pacific Ocean, across Pacific peoples, because Matariki marks where the sun is going to rise from at this time of year in the winter solstice in the southern hemisphere and the summer solstice in the northern hemisphere. However, some iwi across Aotearoa, some places in Te Tai Tokerau, Te Tai Hauru, the west coast, like Taranaki area, and some places within Te Waipounamu, we celebrate Puanga instead because on those western coasts, there's sometimes some obstruction or, you know, more cloud, fog, forests or mountains that get in the way of your view of the eastern horizon. So if it's, you know, Matariki, you already struggle to see it if your eyesight isn't great. So add those obstructions to it, it becomes even harder to see. However, at the same time of year, Puanga sits a bit higher. It's significantly brighter and can be seen even on the west coast of Aotearoa.
So based on the geographical differences between different iwi, are there differences in the way that iwi recognise both Matariki and Puanga across the motu?
Yes, definitely. Rereata Makiha is a national expert on Maramataka, says there's over 500 different Maramataka. That's our Maori lunar stellar environmental calendar. So there's just about as many variations on how to celebrate Matariki and celebrate Puanga, celebrate the Maori New Year. When they got their Matariki Advisory Committee together and they brought experts from different geographies all over the country to decide when this public holiday would be and put it into legislation, each expert came with a different day and a different variation of how it should be celebrated and a different way of how to celebrate it. So I'm really looking forward to the national broadcast this year with Jay Wilson and Ngāti Rangi showing a Puanga variation of the celebrating the Māori New Year.
So why might some Māori from iwi that recognise Puanga also celebrate Matariki?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. I think we've got to understand that these celebrations are in the context of revitalisation. And I think Rangi Mātāma has done a really amazing job of revitalising Matariki traditions and tātaurangi, Māori astronomy more generally. So if you don't have that kōrero tuku iho, if you don't have those words passed down through your people and you're trying to revitalise these traditions, that Matariki tradition and the way that Rangi Mātāma has shared how to hold a haitapu, a umu kohu kohu whetū, those traditions for Matariki, is where a lot of people start. So part of my work, I'm doing a fellowship with Atlantic Fellows for Social Equity. Part of my work is looking at Te Tai Tokerau specific maramataka, and that's including our Puanga traditions, and try to revitalise a Te Tai Tokerau Ngāpui specific celebration of Puanga.
So why isn't Puanga recognised as a national holiday here in Aotearoa?
Like, it kind of is. There were conversations really early on when the bill was first proposed back in 2009 that Matariki is more commonly celebrated across Aotearoa, but that there were regional differences. For example, it's not just Matariki, it's not just Puanga that we celebrate as stars of the year. There's also the setting of Rehua and Tauris and Scorpius to the west that some iwi use. There's also the rising of Atitahi, Canopus, the second brightest star. The way I understand it is this public holiday is really there so that everyone's got a day where they lock up, celebrate, and it's named Te Rā Aroki a Matariki, the Matariki Observance Day, but it doesn't limit Māori to just celebrating Matariki, to just celebrating on that day either. For example, within Te Tai Tokerau, our tradition would be to celebrate Puanga a week earlier on the
full moon nights on Ōturu, Rākau Nui, Rākau Matohi, and we'd have a three-day festival for Pūanga. But just because you're celebrating a three-day festival for Pūanga a week earlier doesn't mean that you're not allowed to celebrate Matariki with the public holiday and the week-long celebration that starts, according to me, starts tomorrow with the first phase of Tangaroa moons, which is the third quarter moon.
Can you tell us about the impacts that light pollution and satellite deployment might have on observing Pūanga and Matariki?
This is something that happened for a lot of us around the country, and I remember looking on social media and there were a lot of aunties and uncles, a lot of people going up to look in 2022 at the time of Matariki for the first time and looking up for such an extended period of time. And we were doing a hautapu celebration for Matariki down in Wāhipa. And just as we're doing our tukuwairo, just as we're sending off those who have passed away from last Matariki to this one, we had, I think it counted like 36 Starlink satellite chain cutting right past through Matariki when we're, you know, naming and sending off our mate with karakia. So that's a very clear example of how our unregulated space sector internationally can actually very directly affect the revitalization of Māori astronomy and the tikanga associated with that. And the other thing that's really happening around light pollution is there's two sources of light pollution. There's earthbound sources, which is, you know, street lights, big cities, all of those types of light pollution, increasing the brightness of the sky. Some research had it at increasing the brightness of the sky 10% year upon year over the last 12 years. That means if you're in a really great area where you can see almost all the stars and the brightness continues to increase like that, within 10 years you only see 200 stars. If you can see 200 stars now, within 10 years of increasing earthbound light pollution, you'll only be able to see 100 stars. So you can see this exponential loss of the number of stars we can see in the night sky due to earthbound sources.
And lastly, what are some steps that we can take individually to reduce the impacts of light pollution?
Yeah, I think one of my dreams with Matariki is, you know how we have Earth Hour where everyone across the world turns off all of the completely unnecessary, you know, the ones that don't risk safety, all earthbound sources of light. I reckon that would be a really amazing thing for us to do as Aotearoa, for turn off the streetlights that we don't need at that time when everyone is out there observing Matariki, turning off the lights in the house, sending emails to your council to change what type of streetlights and what type of public lighting they have so that light just goes down instead of out and up. And if we make all of these changes, if we turn off all the lights that we don't need, even in the middle of Tāmaki Makaurau, even in the middle of Auckland, if you go up to Takaparawhai with Ngāti Whātua Ki Ōrākei, you could see the stars in a way that you've never seen them before as we all go to look up at Matariki. Everyone, even when your eyesight isn't 20/20, can have a chance to actually see and observe Matariki for the first time. And you'll see the sky like it's never been seen within our lifetime in the middle of Auckland. The other thing that we can do to make a difference is Aotearoa is actually quite a big player within the space sector internationally. There's the usual big population, big money countries like US, Russia, China, India, who are big players in the space sector. And then in the top five is little old Aotearoa. So what we do in terms of policy, in terms of regulation, in terms of how we as a country regulate and operate within space sustainably really makes a difference at the international scale. So if this is something that you observe and if this is something that is affecting your ability to have a meaningful relationship with the night sky, then we can do things like write to our MPs, and we literally have a minister for space. We can send emails to their publicly available email address and letters and tell them what we want to see in the night sky and how we want to lead the space sector internationally.
And that was Te Kahuratai Moko Painting from the Centre for Pūtaiao at the University of Auckland, talking to us about why some iwi look to Pūanga instead of Matariki. We'll be back after a quick break. Keep it on the B.
95 BFM.
My hoki mai anō. Welcome back to The Wire on 95BFM. Once again, if you have any thoughts on any of these pieces, text us on 5395 or call us on 309-3879. A quick content warning before we play this next interview. The following story contains discussions of eating disorders. Recently, RNZ published an article about a young person who passed away in 2023 in emergency accommodation due to his battle with his eating disorder. However, the article has faced backlash for its portrayal of the young person. Despite the young person in question, Alex, who identified as trans, the article, at his parents' request, referred to him by his dead name and incorrect pronouns. The article mixed in non-gender-specific pronouns and the name V, depending on an individual's relationship to Alex that was not his parents'. News and editorial director Joel spoke to the president of the Professional Association for Transgender Health Aotearoas, Jennifer Shields, about RNZ's coverage and how this may impact trans rangatahi in the country.
What was your immediate reaction to this article as someone involved in transgender health?
Yeah, I mean, it was obviously a really tragic story, right? I think New Zealand's trans community is small enough that every loss is felt really dearly. So that was really my first reaction, is thinking of the grief that this has caused, not just for this family, but for the people that knew Alex and the people in his community.
What implications could reporting like this have on the country's trans rangatahi, especially coming from Aotearoa's state broadcaster?
Yeah, it's obviously really concerning, right? Trans people really do deserve dignity in death and deserve to be remembered and honoured as who we were in life, and I think It's a worry that a lot of us have, you know, how we will be remembered once we're gone, and the, yeah, concerning opportunities that exist for people to reject who we were in life.
Should there be better regulations to address transgender people accurately in reporting? And if so, what would this look like?
Yeah, I think we're certainly in need of some stronger guidance and a larger piece of work around dealing with myths and disinformation. I think that's really at the core of a lot of the issues that our community is facing at the moment, and this one is unfortunately no exception. We're aware that the story was really promoted by a particular anti-trans activist group who utilised a lot of disinformation in their work, and I think that's had an influence on how this story was reported.
How important is it to use someone's preferred name and pronouns in healthcare?
Yeah, so important. We've got really good research evidence that shows that just one place in a young person's life that uses their name and pronoun correctly reduces their risk of suicidal behaviour by 56%. So just one environment is having a really significant positive benefit on their well-being. So it's really important that we make sure that as many places as possible in someone's life really reflect who they are.
Alex's parents in the article alleged that multiple agencies failed Alex, claiming that care providers were too caught up in referring to him with his preferred name and pronouns that they overlooked his eating disorder. How do you see this?
I think it's a really tragic death, obviously, and I think just in many of the ways that, you know, gender affirming care and mental health support is underfunded and under resourced here in Aotearoa, we see the same for those navigating challenges with eating disorders. I think reading through the messages that Alex shared in this online forum where we are able to hear his own voice, you can hear how important it was that he was acknowledged as who he was. And I really want to commend the social services and in particular the motel owner where he was staying in his, you know, towards the end of his life, who sounds like it really, really took a lot of care for him.
What would you hope would be an adequate response from RNZ to the concerns people have over the reporting of the story?
Yeah, I think at the very least they need to make a public statement and apologise for the harm that this has caused, and show some accountability for how they will prevent things like this happening in the future. Speaking to our communities now, to really encourage people to reach out to those around them and to check in with their friends and their families. I know a lot of people around the country have been really personally affected by this story, so if you have a trans person in your life, I would really encourage you to take the time now to check in with them and see how they're doing and see what they might need.
The coverage of the story has also raised the question of what responsible coverage should look like for a story like this. According to RNZ's Rainbow Communities reporting and content guidelines, as Alex could not communicate his wishes, RNZ opted to cover the story the way that they did through his parents. News and editorial director Joel also spoke to the academic advisor to journalism at AUT, Greg Treadwell, about the coverage of the story and if he believes the coverage is adequate.
What are your thoughts on how RNZ has portrayed the story?
I think it's an unfortunate story to be publishing right now, and I think it wasn't handled very well. I think that there's still a gap between some newsrooms and the trans community. This gap's closing. I've seen trans students come through our own degree studying journalism, and I know they're out there, trans journalists, and it just is, you know, eventually they'll get to positions of power, I guess, within the newsroom. But I think this does highlight still a gap between some newsroom practices and the realities faced by the trans community, and I think that's disappointing. I think that journalists have a responsibility towards all voices in society, and it's not as if trans people have suddenly appeared on our radar. So I have to balance that by saying I do understand a newsroom's impulse to give voice to the parents of Alex, because their lived experience was their lived experience, and to not allow people to have their lived experience acknowledged in the media, the wider media, is, you know, the very case that Alex went through. So I think that, you know, everybody has a story to tell, and, you know, depending on news priorities, of course, everybody's story is worth telling. But I think that the world's got more complex, and I think journalism has to become more complex. And I did say to a panel of news editors, senior news editors at the conference a year or two ago, are you ready? Are you ready for the young trans journalists that are coming through? Are you ready for the way young people see gender? Because I don't think you are. And they all sort of nodded in a kind of compassionate way, but I said, I don't think you are by that very answer. I don't think you have any idea what's coming your way in terms of gender consciousness and gender affirmative social perspectives. And, you know, I think they took it on board, but I don't think I see that kind of knowledge being portrayed in this story. And from a journalistic point of view, there's a really important principle that we do not interfere in the processes of justice. And there is a coronial report coming out soon, and this was the ideal moment, I believe, to say in the RNZ newsroom, we have these sources who want to tell their story, and that's fair enough, but this is definitely a story to be told after the coronial report is released. My problem with the story, I think, is that there's scarcely an expert voice in there, only reported experts, and not the actual voice of somebody who understands the life that Alex might have been leading. So I think that was a big failure, especially given that there were all these experts available once the coronial report was out, because those experts were respecting the coronial process and declining to comment because of the justice process that was underway. And I think the newsroom should have gone, we're going to hold back too. These people have offered to tell us their story, and we're listening, but this isn't the time to interfere in what might have been a much more considered view of the loss of this young man's life.
The head of Rights Aotearoa, formerly known as Countering Hate Speech Aotearoa, Paul Thistle, has made a complaint to the coroner, with further plans to file a complaint to the Human Rights Commission and the Broadcasting Standards Authority. Regarding the latter, what are the logistics looking like for the Broadcasting Standards Authority to uphold this and other complaints regarding the article?
That's really something for the BSA to decide, obviously. But they have a principle against discrimination and for diversity. So I assume that would be the test. I'm not entirely sure until I see the complaint. But I will be very interested in the BSA's view of this. If it was a text story, I'm not sure that it shouldn't be going to the New Zealand Media Council, to be honest, but I'll just leave that for the authorities to sort out.
Could an article like this lead to the distrust of reporting in the country regarding transgender identities?
Well, yeah, on the progressive side of life, most definitely. I think the impact on the trans community of a single story needs to be really, really considered. I mean, can I urge your listeners to go and read David Farrier's response to this, because David Farrier has got access through a little bit of journalistic work, nothing too investigative or melodramatic, but David Farrier has managed to get access to a lot of Alex's postings. And they show an incredible side to this young man's life, a view that we just don't get through the RNZ article, which is another reason for not jumping at this story. You know, it's better to be right than first. And believe it or not, that is what I teach my journalism students. I think David Farrier's piece, because it's quite extraordinary. And then you start to understand, really, from the trans community's point of view, what the problem with this story is. And also, there's an excellent piece by two academics on the spin-off website. And I would really strongly recommend that Radio New Zealand, if it hasn't already, republishes the spin-off piece to give its audience, you know, another view of what's going on.
And you briefly touched on this just then, but how would you suggest RNZ go about these concerns people have with this, with the reporting of the story?
I mean, I understand the criticism that RNZ deadnamed Alex because he wasn't around to say what he wanted. But when you read David Farrier's piece, I mean, it didn't take much to work out, really, what should have how this person should have been referred to through the story. So I think maybe an acknowledgement of that, given David Farrier's work on it, RNZ has now more access to details around this story and should probably respond to that. But I also think, as I said before, that republishing the piece by the academics that the spin-off published would be really, really helpful, because it's a deeply knowledgeable piece of academic writing. The RNZ story grips you with the drama, and there's nothing wrong per se about drama in news, because news stories have to catch your attention. They're not dry academic reports, but when you do read the view of experts on these issues, then you start to understand exactly the deficiencies of that story. And you know, I just think it's time for all journalists to sit down and think about these issues, frankly.
And that was the Professional Association for Transgender Health, Aotearoa's Jennifer Shields, and AUT's Greg Treadwell, on the concerns many have regarding RNZ's coverage of a story on a young person passing away in emergency accommodation. Resources for trans teenagers and for mental health will be available on the podcasted version of this interview on 95bfm.com/bcasts.
That was The Wire.
O e rā te hōtaka katoa mō tēnei wiki, nei te mihi kia koutou katoa I kōrero mai ki au mō tēnei rā.
That's a wrap on the Wednesday Wire. Thanks to everyone who spoke with us today. The Green Party's Ricardo Menendez-March, Iranian New Zealander Mariam, the University of Auckland's Stephen Hoadley and Te Kahuratai Moko Painting, the Professional Association for Transgender Health Aotearoa's Jennifer Shields, and AUT's Greg Treadwell. Nei rā hoki te mihi ki a koutou e whakarongo ana. Thanks for tuning in to 95BFM. Next up is the Wednesday 1-4 with Bridge. Have a great day and keep it on the B.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.